Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
And welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Ann W. Smith, co-chair with Lynn Curtis of the club's Member-Led Arts Forum and your organizer for this program. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now I'm delighted and honored to introduce our speakers for today, and I'm delighted to be able to moderate our discussion. Francesca Zambello is the director of the production of The Ring. She's the recipient of the San Francisco Opera Medal in 2015. She began her long association with the company in 1983 and has been involved in more than 50 productions, including Aida, Louisa Miller, Showboat, Porgy and Bess, and the 2011 Ring Cycle, La Traviata, La Vox Humaine, La Boheme, Prince Igor, Hanifa, and the West Coast premiere of Rachel Portman's The Little Prince, and the world premieres of Heart of a Soldier and Two Women. She's currently general and artistic director of the Glimmerglass Festival and artistic director of the Washington National Opera. In addition to her work in opera, she's also staged plays and musicals on Broadway and around the world. Her many honors include Francis Chevalier des Arts de Lettres and the Russian Federation's Medal for Service to Culture, 3 Oliver Awards, 2 French Grand Prix de Critique, and Australia's Helpman Award. She began her career as an assistant director to the late Jean-Pierre Ponelle. Matthew Shilvuck has devoted his career to the executive management in the performing arts. He was born in the 70s, after I saw my first ring in Kidderminster, England, studied music performance and history, reading music at Christ Church, Oxford University, and holds a master's degree in public administration. He's worked with the New Chamber Opera in England, the Port Opera in Portland, Maine, and was a 2002 fellow with Opera America. He's worked with a variety of companies in North America, Pittsburgh, Houston Grand Opera, Glimmerglass Opera, and he became the general director of Houston's Grand Opera in 2003. And David Gockley brought him here.
Assistant to the general
director. Well.
I don't want to claim.
Okay. So starting his upward trajectory, right? He came to San Francisco Opera in 2005 as part of David Gockley's transition team, and then became the company's seventh general director in August 2016. So we're getting an inside look at the conception and production development of San Francisco Opera's vast and dramatic production of the 2018 Ring Cycle. I remember being in standing room the first time that I was watching it in San Francisco, 1972, as I said, before Matthew was born. And a nice gentleman, just at the end of the first intermission, I think he was probably heading to the bar downstairs, just gave me his ticket for the second part. I don't remember which one it was. Probably De Valkyrie. And it was just so wonderful to do. I could, in those days, I could curl up in the seat and watch, you know. And it was this wonderful total suspension of disbelief in order to experience The Ring. And it was so beautiful. Now I think we want to have a look. We have a video to start things off. Thank you. Francesca will kind of lead us into this particular production, her approach to it, what's different from earlier productions. For those of you, many of you I suspect are familiar, but for those of you who aren't, she'll kind of capsulize the ring for us, for starters.
I'll do my best at that. Thank you for coming.
25 words.
Thank you
or
for
less.
Coming. And I want to make sure that everybody who's never seen The Ring and doesn't know it is as included as the Ringophiles who I know are probably here. So just a brief, quick overview. The Ring Cycle is a monumental work. It's about 18 hours long. It's four operas by Richard Wagner, written 1850s and 1860s, and it tells an incredible mythic story of a family of the gods, Wotan being basically the father of all of this. And it charts a journey of what would not just be gods, but let's say really like mortals, the story of how their love and greed and family foibles lead eventually to the destruction of the world and eventually the rebirth of the world. That's the one-minute version of The Ring. And that would carry you through a cocktail party successfully. But The Ring is something that touches on so many themes which keep feeling incredibly current and modern to us today, because it does tell the stories that many of us know well, which is family trauma, family dilemmas, how love resonates through our life. And in the case of I think what was even in Wagner's time and is even more important today, is how we misuse and destroy nature and hope that it will regenerate itself, and it often doesn't. And so those are the themes that The Ring addresses. We did The Ring here in San Francisco in its complete version, which are called Cycles, in 2011. I'm sure some people here saw it. Yes, no, maybe. Yes, okay, I see some show of hands. Great. But I'm also want to make sure that people who didn't see it are going to go into it, let's say, somewhat informed. And I always say to people, the ring is like just a great story. Don't be afraid of it. And that has been very much my approach, has been in a way when I said, they may be gods, but they really have all of our regular problems. It is really a story which can capture you and draw you in. And it has been my approach as a director to try and make all of the characters as human as possible and to make the storytelling as clear as possible. And yes, I do believe you give over to it, but you're giving over to the majesty and the power of music. The music is overwhelming. It is one of the greatest highs experiencing this music. And so I have felt that my job as the director has really been to make it as accessible as possible to audiences by making the storytelling as clear as possible. So that was my goal in 2011. It continues to be my goal in 2018. You asked about changes. For those of you who saw it before, there are basically three things that change a lot, and this can affect you if you've never seen it. One, in opera, casts change. You know, and many of you I know, let's say, you know, we always like to see a new King Lear. We always like to see a new Hamlet. Well, we always like to see a new Brunhilde. We always like to see a new Wotan, those being the two central protagonists of The Ring. And so with each cast that you have as a director, I think it's my job to work with them to bring out the best of the individuals and to help fuse them with the characters as much as possible. The other thing that has changed, I think, dramatically since 2011 for us is, and appropriate in San Francisco, is technology. Technology is a part of the Ring Cycle in the sense of the visuals. The visuals use projections, which have changed the ability to project things. Even the sophistication of these screens in here 2011, they weren't this good. So that has been a big part of it and how we have deployed technology. And then last, in a way, is like all great works, whether we are experiencing great literature, great art, great music, the issues of our world, I think, affect how we see these great stories. And particularly in the last 7 years, the issues of Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, all of these things, in a funny way, are part of The Ring, or they make us see these works in a different way. So for me, those have been the three big changes since 2011. Okay, was that a good short Ring primer for everybody? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I just want to say something about this production, because there are many, many different interpretations of The Ring. As Francesca said, it is such a deep canvas that you can take it in many different directions, and many directors do. And what I love about what Francesca has done with this production is that it has a very strong point of focus. It is not just saying, you know, this is a carbon copy of the opening of The Ring in Bayreuth in 1876. It's saying something very contemporary, very relevant, and very important, but at every single juncture, you feel the storytelling that Wagner intended. There's nothing of conflict with the music in The Ring. And so as an audience member, you can sit back and you can feel like you're on this incredible journey. You're not trying to figure out what the director is telling you, because Francesca's so clear in her storytelling that you feel that as naturally as you feel the music. And that is not a common thing in a Ring cycle. That often is in tension with each other as the music and the storytelling try and jockey for prime position. In this Ring, I think more than any of the Rings that I've seen, you feel that great symbiosis, which is really what you want when you're on a 15-hour journey. You want to feel like you are completely immersed in the ride. So I've just been so impressed by how you've done that, Francesca. It's not easy at all.
Thank you. I just would want to add the visual world of this Ring cycle does use a lot of, let's say, American visuals, American iconography. And part of that, again, was to make people realize that this story that is based on Greek, Nordic, Germanic myths is actually very much like our own myths and our own stories that are inherent, I think, in our land and in our subconscious. And so The Ring, this production, uses a visual tableau that suggests, in a way, beginning in the mid-19th century in California with the gold rush, and then moves forward by the end of Götterdämmerung to some sort of futuristic Mad Max, Handmaid's Tale kind of world. And so it just really follows that. And there are a number of other California references along the way, which I'm happy to discuss as we get more specific.
I understand that the singers need to have a certain kind of voice. Is that true? In order to be able to sing this material. Someone said, I was Googling a little, and that you're talking about Birgit Nilsson having the perfect Wagnerian voice, and she had a voice like a laser. And I thought, well, that's an interesting description of a voice.
I think it's voices that sing Wagner tend to be bigger than voices that sing operas by Handel or Mozart. And we're very fortunate to have the wonderful former music director Donald Runicles conducting this cycle. He is a Wagnerian supreme. So I don't think he's a heavy-handed Wagnerian conductor. He's not going to bury the singers. He's extremely sensitive to the balance between voice and orchestra. And of course here, you know, it's an open pit. It's uncovered. When Wagner built his, because no theater was big enough to do the Ring cycle, he built his own theater. Lucky guy. But he was very fortunate because King Ludwig of Bavaria was his main sponsor, just like all of you who are very generous to the opera. We appreciate that. If anybody wants to build a new theater, just let us know. But there the pit is covered in Bayreuth, which was Wagner's home. And so now conductors tend to need, to really balance it. So Wagnerian voices tend to be bigger. They tend to be voices that sing much bigger repertory. For example, when we had that genealogy tree up there, Greer Grimsley, who is Votan, sings Johanahan and Salome, Pizarro and Fidelio, a number of Strauss roles. Irene Tieren, who's our Brunhilde, sings all of the big Wagner roles as well. Kari Tamatila, you know, she began her career singing smaller things, and her voice got bigger and bigger. And that's kind of what happened. So, yes, of course, Birgit Nielsen, who celebrated her 100th birthday 2 days ago, not for rich, centenary of her birth, was one of the great Wagnerians. And it seems to be that the water in Scandinavian countries contributes to a lot of great Wagnerian singers.
I know. I think this will be our fourth Swedish Brunhilde, and add a Norwegian Brunhilde into the mix as well. There's absolutely something strange going on there. And
Can we put the tree up again?
The stamina of a Wagnerian singer is a huge part of that as well. Not just in the performances, but in the rehearsal process as well. Francesca and I were just talking beforehand just about the sheer length of getting through the scenes of the Ring cycle. And you put a singer on stage and their natural tendency is to want to sing out, particularly when the orchestra is there. And when you're getting through these 4 or 5 hour rehearsals night after night for those big roles like Votan and Brunhilde and Alberic, you have to find that right pacing. Otherwise, you can just completely lose your voice by the time of opening night. So there's a huge element of stamina and reserve. And I think as a result, Wagnerian singers tend to be very measured, very, very thoughtful, incredibly prepared in their process, because there's just no other way to do it.
It's just very long. You know, when you rehearse, we were just talking about this, when you rehearse, let's say, an opera by Verdi, a scene, La Traviata, Aida, whatever, most scenes are 15 minutes long. So generally, as a director, you think, okay, I'm going to rehearse that scene for 3 hours, and then we'll run it a couple of times. Well, in every one of the Ring operas, every scene is like 45 minutes long. So it takes you much longer to put it together. And then when you say, oh, let's run that scene, you've got to make sure you have the afternoon to run through it or something. It's just the scale of everything is much bigger. And for the singers, you know, there's a word where we say they will mark something, meaning they will not sing it out in full voice. They'll speak the words or sing very softly. So they, too, have to measure themselves, because just to get to a Ring cycle, if you're going backwards, let's say we have 3 Ring cycle performances in June. Hope you all have your tickets and you're bringing your friends. Before that means we would have had 1 week of a dress rehearsal. Before that, 1 week of what we call pre-dress rehearsal, orchestra techs. 1 week before that of piano dress rehearsals. 1 week before that of piano technical rehearsals. And then before that, all of what we call the room rehearsals. So it's a lengthy process.
And although the big weight is definitely on the people like Votan, like Brunhilde, many of the smaller roles are cross-cast. And so some of the Rhine maidens who open the cycle come back as Valkyries in the Ride of the Valkyries. And other people are covering other roles as well. And so it's a incredibly complicated process just to figure out the rehearsal schedule of this and how all of these different operas overlay on each other. And in fact, we had a little gathering for the cast about 2 weeks into the rehearsal process, and many of them were meeting each other for the first time because they never cross paths in rehearsal because they're always being diverted off to somewhere else. So it's there is really nothing else quite like it for a company in terms of how to apportion the rehearsal time to make sure you get through all of this. That we did it before in 2011 is hugely helpful. I think particularly for those very complex scenes like the Rhine Maidens and the Valkyries, because many of those people are the same. But then you want to give it time to rebuild again, to build afresh 7 years later. So we've been going for 4 weeks already now. We have another 3 weeks left. It's an incredible process.
And you've been ringing it, as they say, with a number of different types of events. Can you tell us about some of those and Are there any left?
There's plenty.
This is
left.
One of them.
This is one of them. I was going to say you're sitting in the midst of one of them. Mm-hmm. The ring is such a multifaceted lens through which to view life, and there are so many disciplines through which you can view the ring. It's people are on basically a lifelong journey with this piece, and some people who are coming in 2018, this will be their 50th ring, their 60th ring. And some people basically gear their entire life's travel based on the ring cycle, because you can keep going into it from so many different perspectives. And so anytime a ring comes into town, whichever city it is, I know Francesca did this in Washington as well, you really gather the entire community around to explore the ring, to delve into the ring. There are many pre-events like this one where we're getting people excited and giving them a chance to interact with it before it happens. And then when it happens in San Francisco in those 3 weeks in June, you can go as deep as you want, because we have events on every day. We have symposia. We have day-long forums. We have introductory lectures. We have a Ring 101 series. We even have a family event which can go down as low as toddlers in age. We can get immersion around the ring in any way that you would like to do it. One thing I'm particularly excited about, on the Thursday night off, if you're coming to the ring, then don't take that night off on Thursday, because you can come and see the great San Francisco Opera Chorus in concert with a whole series of great Wagner choruses. The chorus is used almost not at all in the ring. You have to wait until the fourth opera, Götterdämmerung, to get any chorus. And then the female chorus is only used for about 12 measures within that. It was not particularly efficient casting by Wagner there to bring an entire female chorus in just for a few measures. Thankfully, Francesca uses them in a wonderful way in the drama of the Götterdämmerung as well. But that's another chance to see Wagner, to see the ring from a different perspective. And I think you should all have one of these little brochures on your chair. And so I encourage you to see what else is happening as we go through this Ring Festival, and just make it as much a part of your life as you have time for. Because I think the ring, the more you can give that ring, the more you can immerse yourself in it, the better you will take it. Try not to get to the theater, 2 minutes before the curtain goes down. Get to the theater in good time, have some food, pace yourself, get hydrated. Just be a part of the ring. Give yourself over to that ring for a complete week. And, we only do it every 10 years or so. So it's a chance to just luxuriate in one of the great artworks ever created. And hopefully through this Ring Festival, you'll find many chances to do that.
Do I have to buy everything, or can I just go to one? And which one would I go to if I could only go to one?
Of the operas themselves?
Mm-hmm.
You can now buy single tickets. There are a few left. I think probably the Valkyrie would be the one I would choose, just in terms of the mixture of the very famous bits, like the Ride of the Valkyries, but then these incredible love scenes, the love scene between Siegmund and Sieglinde at the beginning, and then, of course, that unbelievably heartfelt farewell between Wotan and Brunhilde at the end, which for me, now with a four-year-old daughter, I think I'm going to be a complete mess at the end of that. Mm-hmm. But what about you, Cheska? If you could only pick one?
I mean, conventionally people say Valkyrie is the best one-off, but I don't know. I'm the wrong person, because I love every single minute. So I'm like, yeah, just start with the beginning with a single ticket, and then you'll realize you need to buy the rest.
Should we have?
And also, Rheingold is short. Rheingold is like 2.5 hours long. I mean, the movies are longer now. So you do that one, no intermission. You do that, and then you're like, okay, all right, I'll go for the rest.
You build your ring muscle over the week.
Do you want to have a look at the slides and speak about each one?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We just brought a couple of images. Can we make that full screen, or is that possible? Yeah, just this is to give people a little sense of the visual. This is from Rheingold. This is a scene where Alberich, who is the person who sets the drama in motion, actually, in the first scene of Rheingold, he steals the gold from the Rhine River. Rhine, of course, means clean in German, and Rheingold obviously suggests the gold in the Rhine, which is hence the title of the first opera. It is almost to me like he rapes the river when he steals this from these three very virginal women. They're guarding the gold. And this first action of destruction of nature is truly what sets the story in motion. This is a scene in Rheingold where he has a number of slaves called the Nibelungen. He is a member of the race from Nibelheim. He himself is a Nibelung. So anybody who's read Lord of the Rings or, you know, sat through Star Wars, you know, you'll get this. There are these different races in the piece. Anyway, so this is a scene where he is celebrating his victory of having all the gold before he encounters Wotan, who steals the ring from him, the physical ring. Then the next image, this is a picture from the opera from Valkyrie. It's from the first act of Valkyrie. This is where we meet the characters Siegmund and Sieglinde. They are twin brother and sister, but it's not, and they fall in love with each other, but it's not incest. It's really more about these two people having sort of the same soul who are joined together. And this is like a major Me Too scene because she is married to Hunding, who is kind of a character who basically lives in the film Deliverance and is a very abusive husband. And one day, Siegmund shows up on her door, the character on the right, and they immediately fall in love. And he, there is, in this house where she lives with Hunding, there's unfortunately a sword stuck in the tree, which Wotan stuck it there, and he pulls out that sword with her help, and he runs off with her, therefore infuriating her husband, Hunding, who comes eventually after Siegmund and manages to kill him. But this is just an image of sort of incredible love. This is when they fall in love and consummate their love. And the image was really very much, it starts out that there's a house, there are the walls of the house on the side, which does feel like some sort of house in Appalachia, which with Siegmund's arrival, nature appears and breaks it open. And it's one of the more famous musical passages in the piece. So that's a little image from that. And then the next picture, this is when he pulls the sword. The sword has a name. The sword's name is Notung. It's like Darth Vader's spear. I mean, it's like every, you know, it's like when in Arthur, when they pull the sword out of the rock, blah, blah. So the sword Notung is a character in the Ring cycle and extremely important. And one way that I play it as a director is that he doesn't pull the sword out of the tree by himself, that she helps him do it, so that they've done it together and they are united through that. And what ends up happening is this sword manages to live a long time in the piece because it, at the end of Valkyrie, when he dies, his sword breaks and she is pregnant with their child, Siegfried, and she saves the shards of the sword, and eventually Siegfried in the next opera puts them back together, therefore wielding the sword, which will eventually lead him to victory and to finding Brunhilde. But then eventually it kills him. Anyway, you'll get that. Okay. And then the next image, this is a scene, very famous, The Ride of the Valkyries. The designers, Kathy Zuber Costumes, Michael Jürgen and Sets, and Katie Tucker Projections. We were very inspired by the Women's Flight Corps from World War II, which is what inspired these costumes. Of course, that music is probably the most famous music in the Ring cycle, made famous in Apocalypse Now. And of course, Bugs Bunny used it. And it's thrilling music. It's thrilling music. And so I think it's very empowering. It's definitely girl power theme.
Just one quick note. Yeah. Francesca was talking about very subtle American iconography, and there's a very, very localized, beautiful, I think, reference here. And this rock, Brunhilde's rock, I don't know if you recognize it, but it's taken from the armament positions in the Marin Headlands, and those big concrete bunkers there, and then the positions, the circular positions there. I just love that connection.
Yeah, that was when we were designing the ring, we were walking in the headlands, and we were like, oh, wait a minute, this should be like the rock. Let's see, next image. This is a scene from Siegfried. That's Siegfried on the right of the image. My right, your left. And He's speaking with a character called the Forest Bird there, who is a person who gives him the news of how to go and find Brunhilde. That large machine is the dragon, which it's kind of based on a garbage compactor. It was the dragon. It was Fafnir, who was a giant, who tries to kill him, who's been protecting the gold. And so he eventually kills this machine, which is why you see suddenly the green around, because the forest opens up to him and the bird comes.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And then the last image...
Was the machine always part of it?
No, that was sort of how we chose to interpret the dragon. Mm-hmm. And then this is just the one of the images near the end. These are the three Rhine maidens when they finally do get the ring back, thanks to Brunhilde's actions, where she really saves the world. I definitely think that Brunhilde is the great hero in the piece. Wotan says in the second opera, Valkyrie, that he's searching for the perfect hero to solve his problems. He says this to his daughter, not realizing that the perfect hero is actually his daughter. But dads don't always understand. Take note, okay? And this is one of the final scenes where the Rhine maidens are finally returned. They are given back the gold, and the world is born anew. And would that it was as simple as this actually nowadays. So those are some of the visual images from the ring. I see some questions piling up here. So
they're starting to.
Another question before we get to some of the audience ones. This seems to be have a very somewhat of a feminist perspective. Would you say that as a director?
Some people have said that. I don't like sit there and go, oh, it's a feminist interpretation.
Right. Okay, good.
I mean, there are a lot of women in the ring, and a lot of them do really great things, notably Brunhilde. Mm-hmm. Also, not just that she is the hero, really, of the piece, but there are other very noble women in it. Fricka, the wife of Wotan, I think is very important. She tries to uphold the values of marriage to her husband. He, mind you, has gone off with Erda and has fathered eight other daughters. So he's not like the perfect husband.
Another Henry.
Right. And then, of course, the Rhine maidens, I think, are very special characters because they are, the women a lot of times in the piece are trying to do a good job. They try to protect the gold gets taken away from them, they finally get it back at the end. The Norns in Gudrid Dameron are trying to keep history together and they can't seem to quite weave it all together. Finally, Erda is trying to do a good job to tell Wotan, do not mess around with that gold, and he doesn't listen to her. So, it's not like there are bad women in the ring, mm-hmm. really. I mean, maybe somebody out there is going to tell me, well, what about XYZ? But I basically think, the guys don't always do such a good job. I mean, Hagen, Alberich, Gunther, Loga, Mime... Wotan, I mean, their actions are pretty questionable.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think that meant that Wagner had a particular perspective as he was developing these roles?
Well, there are many theories on Wagner's mm-hmm. views on women. I prefer the women in the ring to, let's say, Eva in Meistersinger. Kundry and Parsifal. I like Elizabeth and Venus in Tannhäuser. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows he had a tricky marriage. He had something going with some other women. So it's, of course, he's a composer. Of course, his personal life is going to go into these pieces.
Of course.
But I do think Wagner, like Puccini, Puccini gave us great female characters. Mm-hmm. You know, Minnie, Tosca, Butterfly, Mimi. I mean, they're all women who are, I think, are really interesting women. They're not sort of dodos. And, you know, Ava's a dodo in Meistersinger, in my view. I've always have a problem with her. But I think in The Ring, we have such great female characters. Valtraut. I mean, all these women do such a good job. And those Valkyries schlepping all those heroes off to Valhalla, you know, they're the heroes.
Were there things happening in Wagner's personal life?
I think, you know, I leave that to the reading. Yes.
Okay.
Obviously, he had some serious issues.
But they inspired him, some of them.
Clearly they inspired him. Yeah. So many things inspired him. I mean, you know, nature inspired him. You know, when you just look at his journeys from St. Petersburg to Switzerland to where he ended up in Germany. I mean, mm-hmm. he was absolutely, you know, a citizen of the world at that time and mm-hmm. who tried to reflect his views through his works, which I think is appropriate in the Commonwealth Club as I read about the social missions and social history of and addressing issues in the club's history, which I applaud all members for.
Yes, it's a public affairs forum, so we're looking for stepping back and seeing what the global view is, perhaps, of the art that we surround ourselves with and what music brings to us and what it allows us to, how it allows us to expand our view as well. And I think I have a question here about, and I had experiences with this, listening to Wagner. Any radio broadcasts? Was there any influence on you from the radio? Either of you.
I think before I saw it live, and I was probably around 20 when I first saw it live, I think before then, I just remember kind of just consuming the Met old Otto Schenk DVDs of The Ring and just watching those over and over again, trying to get myself into the story of The Ring, trying to remember the passage of the story and just being overwhelmed by the beauty of that music. But that was, I think, between that and then listening to the Schulte Ring on the Great Decca box set recording, those were my two big early influences, I think. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I when I was in college, I didn't really know the music of Wagner. I did know a fair amount of classical music, mostly from my mother and my grandmother, who loved a lot of opera. But there was a listening room in the library where I used to go and study. That was back in the days of, you know, 33s. And the woman who ran the listening room was obsessed by Wagner. I didn't really understand this or know this. And there was always Wagner playing in there. And I used to go, and that was where I would, like, I hated those carousels, those metal carousels, you know, where we had to sit and everybody was, like, schmoozing each other. So the listening room, nobody seemed to sit in there, really. So I ended up sitting in there a lot and studying and listening to a lot of Wagner. And eventually, of course, I learned what it was. So I thank that woman very much, that librarian, for really introducing me to Wagner.
I think that really helps to have someone to help guide you through it. I was just thinking, as you mentioned that, I was watching those Wagner, the Ring DVDs from the Met with a tuba player who was passionate about the Ring. And, you know, there's nothing like watching the Ring through the eyes of a tuba player. but it helps because it helps personalize it. It helps just give you the context and the background and the sense of wonderment. It doesn't have to feel like this completely insurmountable mountain that you have to climb, but rather something. You see that passion in someone else and you say, I want a piece of that.
Yes. Well, the radio was a huge influence due to my age, of course, and in early life. And the things I recall most clearly are listening to the opera and baseball, where you only experience it from the hearing of it, from the sound.
Well, baseball has something that it shares in common with Wagner, is that baseball is not a sport which is timed, which is one of the annoying things I find about baseball. and, of course, you know, certain conductors are extremely leisurely and can make the ring cycle be 20 hours long.
Oh, no.
So I'm happy to go through those
sure.
other questions.
Let me just take a a bit of a second. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Francesca Zambello and Matthew Shilvock of the San Francisco Opera. Going back to, I guess this would be your from the production organizational standpoint, Matthew. Was there anything in particular that led to the decision to do this production now?
Well, this was a production that we had co-produced with Washington National Opera through Francesca, and I mean, you must have begun discussions with that with David Gockley in 2004, 2005, even earlier.
Yeah, I mean, actually, before David was at San Francisco, right, and he was in Houston, we had talked about doing a ring cycle together, and I remember right when we started talking about it was the oil crisis and the fall of Exxon in Houston. So even though that seemed appropriate for Votan, it definitely wasn't appropriate for engaging into the financial move. And then I was not the artistic director at the Washington National Opera. Placido was then, but I was directing there. And I directed a production of Valkyrie with him as Zygmunt. He was a wonderful Zygmunt. And after doing that, he then invited me to do the ring cycle. And then David became the general director here. And so I talked to David because it's just much more cost effective, which I have to say we have been extremely cost effective between the two companies to produce the ring and to do these cycles a lot cheaper than other companies, which will remain unnamed in this conversation. And I think that's important. You know, it you're is. Like the subscribers and the donors. I think we have to be financially responsible even when we mount these huge, huge projects, you know, like this or the Trojans or Meistersinger or whatever. So co-productions really make it work. And so I was thrilled when David wanted to do it. And then, of course, equally thrilled when Matthew took over and said, I think we should do The Ring again. And I'm glad that it sold so well. There's still tickets available, but it's, you know.
Not many.
Okay.
No, so I think to that point, not only co-producing it, but then doing it, bringing the same production back, as Francesca said, it's a production that is morphing, always growing and changing. So it's by no means a carbon copy of 2011. But companies have to think about the economics of putting on The Ring. It's a very expensive proposition, certainly much cheaper to do it the second time around. But you have to invest a lot of the time and resources of the company and the community into it. So bringing it back after 7 years is a little sooner than usual, probably, but there was so much urgency to see this again based on the experience of 2011, and that has been borne out in the public reaction to us doing it again. So it's a wonderful thing for us to do as a company because the entire company is just focused around this one singular monumental undertaking, and the sense of pride that the company and I think the community feels in that is really extraordinary. And the Lainhoff ring, which was Nicholas Lainhoff was the director of the prior ring here, and that was done three times, if memory serves. And so there's a great tradition of bringing these rings back, of really owning them and feeling very proud of them as they return back into the repertory.
So let's talk about the audience a little bit more. How much of your audience will not have seen Wagner before, or The Ring, or any part of it? Is it mostly repeat customers?
There's a lot of repeat customers. There's about a fifth of the audience, just over 20% of the audience, who has never been to San Francisco Opera before, which I think is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. We don't have specifics on whether they're newbies to The Ring or to Wagner, but I can say we have audience members from 27 countries coming, and audience members within the states from 48 different states. If you know anyone from Mississippi or North Dakota who can help push us over those last two, please tell them they're very welcome. But the sense of energy of the entire world around The Ring, there's no other artistic work quite like it for pulling people in.
That's true.
Kip is from North Dakota. We need to make sure
he buys a staff member is originally from North Dakota. I would count him in there.
Okay.
Let's just get on the phone to Mississippi.
Down to Mississippi.
Mississippi. You're on. So
I feel like we need to answer these audience questions, because I think if when people write questions, I want to make sure to answer them.
Well, some of them we're getting to, yes. How long did it take him to do this work, and then maybe one connected with it? Well, we'll start with that. And then the way that you have interpreted some of the characters in this production, maybe that are a little different, like Siegfried.
Well, Wagner wrote The Ring over about 25 years. He wrote it backwards. Siegfried's Idol, which is very famous orchestral, is from the third opera, Siegfried. He wrote that. That was one of the first things that he wrote. And so he basically started with that part of the story and then went back and filled it in with each work. And what's important about Wagner is that he wrote the words and the music. Very few composers have done that or do that. And of course, he coined a phrase which is important to us, which is Gesamtkunstwerk, which means total work, which is what he felt about theater. So when he wrote this, he wrote the librettos, and then he wrote the music, and often, you know, writing together. Normally the process with a new work is the librettist writes the libretto, the composer then writes the music. And not only did Wagner do that, but, you know, then he, remember I said, he built his own theater. And he also revolutionized something for all of us today that's important, which was he was the first person to turn off the lights in the theater and focus the lights only on the stage. He invented the notion of us sitting in the dark with the stage picture illuminated. So he was, as a practitioner of theater, he was revolutionary. Also the fact that that was a kind of a transition time when he was writing. The conductor's place was, it used to be actually facing the audience. So, and he was one of the first people to bury the conductor, which some directors would like to do anyway, but not Donald. Love him. And to implement that. So, you know, he was also in his scores, he wrote extremely complete stage directions. You know, which as a director, you know, I feel like I've respected about 60% of them, and interpreted them. You know, again, my job is an interpreter. Singer's job, we're interpreters. We are interpreting the original material. So when you ask about, you know, is there a right or a wrong way to interpret a character, you know, people always make me crazy when they say it's supposed to be like this. Well, nothing in the arts is supposed to be like anything. Mm-hmm. We are living, you know, we're interpreters. It's our job to keep examining something. Same way as an audience member, it's your job to keep thinking about something, plus to buy tickets, et cetera. But so I think that, you know, it's not like there's like a right or a wrong. If there was a right or a wrong about the arts, you know, we wouldn't have like Picasso's Blue Guitar.
Exactly. It's about expression as well.
Many things.
You know. So that's what makes it an art form, and among the great art forms, and what makes The Ring among the grandest of operas. I asked you that. Let's see. Is the family genealogy tree, is that on the web? Can you access that on the web?
You can, and okay. It's a great way, actually, if we can put it back up. And I think this is something that Francesca, you guys did in Washington first, if I remember. But to not only learn the genealogy or to kind of familiarize yourself with the genealogy, but to you know, get a feel for who the characters are as through the singers as well. So you can see we've got the names of the singers plus their roles. And one of the things that Francesca's talked about a lot, which really resonated with me, is just how intimate of a family drama this is. And you get a feel for that in this family tree. This is a story about the birth of the world through to the destruction of the world. The epic sense of it is enormous, but it's still a story about a relatively small number of characters. And I think in that is the genius of the Ring cycle. But you can see the interweaving groups of people here. We have the gods, the mortals, the half-gods, the Rhine maidens, and so forth. There are these groups of characters who work in both an archetypal but also a very, very specific sense as well. And so this is a wonderful way to take a snapshot of the ring. There's also a really fun video that I think came out of Australia, which is a 2-minute synopsis of the ring, kind of with someone drawing the characters. And that's another thing I would recommend you take a look at as well.
That sounds amazing. I remember that after having grown up just listening, I had a different image when I saw it. And when I saw it, it was surprising that there were so few characters. Because in imagination, you might think there are more, or that somehow a bigger fantasy, more fantastic, with more people.
Well, the orchestra... Oh, sorry, Jessica.
No, I was just going to say, the other, of course, very important thing that Wagner invented and that helps you follow the ring, even if you subconsciously don't know it but or do know it, is that every character has what is called a leitmotif, which means a motive, a theme. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Wagner was one of the great inventors of that. And so every single character has a tune basically associated with them. So that character appears, we hear the tune. Notung the sword appears, we hear the tune. Somebody says something like, I don't know about that, you hear the scary tune. You know, Brunhilde is referenced, you hear her music. And so one of the great things about Wagner is he gives you a listening thing about every single character, and also every single problem. You know, there's like a treaty theme, there's a love theme, there's just a number of themes that as you study the ring, and you do not have to know these before. If you know them, of course it makes it more fun when suddenly the tuba plays it because you think, oh, the dragon's being referenced, and the dragon's instrument is the tuba. Okay, so that's just sort of part of what I call fun ring game.
And I was just going to say as well, the other main character in the ring is the orchestra.
Yeah,
and the role that the orchestra plays, I think, to your point, Anne, creates this sense of the epic. You think of something like the move down into Nibelheim in Rheingold, and just the complete, almost cinematic orchestration that Wagner is using with 12 real anvils playing along with the orchestra as well. You get that sense of entering this world, you know, just teeming with people, even though you may only have 40 people on stage. So the role that Wagner created with the orchestra, for the orchestra, allows us to create that sense of the epic around this family drama as well.
Just, I love that the anvils are a great way down. It's not just 40 people, it's 40 children.
Yes.
The Nibelungen are children, and it was really important to me to put kids in the ring. It's because the amount of kids who have fallen in love with Wagner's music from being in this production in its many incarnations has been extremely gratifying.
Absolutely.
Is that why we got some promotion about the family matinee or the family programs to encourage children?
You know, I think opera, and even something this big, or particularly something this big, can be an incredible access point for children to understand more adult emotions. You don't have to sit down and talk to them about the nature of grief. They can pick that up very vicariously watching a piece like this. Now, getting an 8-year-old to sit through the entire ring cycle may not be the easiest thing, but giving them access points where they can understand the notion of heroes and gods and monsters, and that almost fairy tale notion of telling the story of human existence through these larger than life characters, it's perfect for children to engage with.
Maybe this is a kid's question, I'm not sure. Is the train going to sing like a dragon?
The garbage compactor sing like it? Yes, it does. It does. It does.
How does a dragon sound?
Long, low, and deep.
Ah.
And
a tuba piece. No.
Yes. You can see the picture of the dragon. It's near the bottom on your left side. It's the singer Andrea Silvestrelli. Oh, no, it's Ray Aceto. That's right.
Fafner.
Right. It's Fafner. Down there near the bottom next to Mime.
We have a little voice alteration at that point. A little
amplification.
Big booby giant.
Can zero in
lower,
on some
there
of these.
You go, yeah.
Well, and one, while we're talking about the giants, one of the great visual excitements about the ring is when the giants come in and that's just one of the audience is just so thrilled about that moment. Can you just mention that, Jessica?
Well, the Giants, so Votan, and everybody's done this, right? Votan signed a contract for a new house. The house is Valhalla. And we've all made bad contracts. And Loga is basically his lawyer. And the house that he is having built is being built by the Giants. Of course, one always calls Giants to build your house because you know it's going to turn out okay. And the Giants' names are Fossold and Fafner. I envisioned them really as like, you know, the contractors who are building your house who are ripping you off. And so when they appear on a huge I-beam because Votan wants Valhalla to be, you know, the biggest, greatest home ever, the home of the gods. And so we have them fly in on an I-beam and they are wearing overalls. And when you see them, they're wearing huge boots, which raise their height up. They give them an extra foot. Plus, they're both very tall men, Ray Aceto and Andrea Silvestrelli. And you'll notice they're carrying like yardsticks for measuring, but they also make sure that they don't fall over because of that.
Well, we're just really getting into it, but we must bring this to an end now. And I encourage you to keep exploring the website and asking the questions. And going to the ring is the thing to do. So I would like to thank you so much, Francesca and Matthew, for bringing your insights to the Commonwealth Club of California. And I would like to bring this meeting of the club, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion. We're adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you.